All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
Okay, welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, CW2 type helicopter pilot in Vietnam in 1969. Welcome to Veterans Radio. As I said before, we're really excited because today we are honoring women. This is Women's Month and we are honoring them right here on Veterans Radio. We've got two guests with us, Sherry Rood and Colonel Christine Cook. And we are going to be talking about some upcoming events here in the local Southeast Michigan area for women veterans. And then we're going to be talking later on with Christine about a little bit of the history of women in the military, because she just recently received her PhD and her dissertation was on women in the military. So I figured I'd go and get the experts. And so we're excited to have them. If you want to get in on the conversation, you can give us a call here on Veterans Radio. The number is 734-822-1600, 734-822-1600. So all of you women veterans out there, if you want to get in on the conversation, feel free to give us a call. Before we get into this, I need to thank our sponsors, because as many of you know, Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio America. Veterans Radio America is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, so you can support us with your donations. And of course, we would be greatly appreciative if you could do that. All you got to do is go to veteransradio.net and click on the donate button. So if you like what we're doing, you can support us. Thanks very much for your continued support. We do have a couple of corporate sponsors that I'd have to recognize. Number one is Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans specializes in veteran disability claims. So give Legal Help for Veterans a call at 800-693-4800. The National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as NVBDC, is the nation's leading third-party authority for the certification of veteran-owned businesses. For more information, you can go to their website, that's nvbdc.org, or you can give them a call at 888-237-8433. NVBDC certifies you as a veteran-owned business. If you want to do business with the federal government and many corporations, and you are a veteran-owned, you need to get certified. And it's kind of a long process, but these folks can help you get through it every step of the way. So check them out, nvbd.org. The Charles S. Kettles VA Medical Center in Ann Arbor, Michigan. For more information, you can go to va.gov/Ann Arbor Healthcare. We also want to thank our local veteran service organizations for their continued support over the last 20 years. This is the Irwin Press Corps and American Legion Post 46 and the Charles S. Kettles Vietnam Veterans of America, Chapter 310, both here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And again, if you want to support us, go to veteransradio.net, click on the donate button. We'd be happy, obviously, to receive your donation. Right now, I want to get into the program, and I want to introduce our first guest, and her name is Shelley Rood. And Shelley is a, she was a captain in the United States Army Reserves. She graduated from Western Michigan. She's a crack shot. She was on the rifle team out there, and now she's very, very active in women's veterans and women's veterans affairs, and she's been on our program before. Can't remember exactly when. I'll have to ask her about that. And so anyway, Shelley, welcome back.
Mr. Dale, it's such an honor to be here. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, this was Others Over Self. That's what we talked about a couple of years ago, not that long ago, really. But you now are involved in, as you mentioned earlier on while we were talking before we came on the air, more and more it's becoming more of your, it just kind of takes over your life now.
It can. Yeah. We've been in business as an educational consulting company since 2017. And in 2019, I was approached by a gentleman from the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, Chaplain Brian Webb. And he said, Shelley, I have this women's program that we really want to do. And I need a female, military female to make it happen. Will you do it? And I said, absolutely. And so it's grown from 2019 all the way until now. Next year, we'll be celebrating 5 years. And that program is peer support. That's as simple as it comes. We provide peer support for Michigan's military women both currently serving and past serving. So if you are a female that has ever served in the military, everything that we do is offered free of charge to you. We're just really here to love on the women and help them be the best versions of civilians that they can be.
Well, I also need to point out that you are a ordained minister. You are the chaplain for a lot of different organizations, and that's how you got another way that you got involved. In fact, you're still involved with that, aren't you?
It is. So, you know, as a young business owner myself, been still reaching for what's next. And outside of the military, I have a love for continued professional development. And something that I was really focused on was becoming a chaplain in the military, actually. Towards the end of my intelligence career, I wanted to branch transfer and be a military chaplain. And sadly, that is a dream that did not come to fruition. I received just time and grade discharge orders. And they said, just go ahead and reenlist as a chaplain right in. Well, wouldn't you know, I don't medically qualify to reenlist in any of the United States military services. So all of a sudden, I found myself as a civilian. I completed my education. I became an ordained minister. I'm a chaplain, and the military is saying no thank you. So I've really had to do a gut check over the last year and think to myself, well, what does that look like? And so it really has been a joy to bring that aspect of my life into everything that we do.
Well, I've seen you in action, and you do a great job, not only with all of your organizations that are helping women veterans, but also I think you help them spiritually as well. You know, especially, you know, some of these women that are making this transition from the military, to civilian life. And it's a whole different, I think it's a sounds to me like a whole different ball game than men transitioning and women transitioning.
I don't know that I ever will transition. I think that my service time, you know, is 16 years across a 16-year span, and it mostly was reserve. And so it's a part of my life. It always has been. I've always worn multiple hats, and, you know, I've been groomed and trained and operating that way for the majority of my adult life. I don't know how to do just one thing. And the communication style, the way that we make friends, the way that we delegate amongst our teammates, we do things in a very unique way. And so one of the modules actually that we teach for our company is military cultural competency. And it's a good lesson for civilians and military people to go through to gain a better understanding of we are different from people who have never served in the military. And that's not a bad thing. But it is something that should be recognized. And yes, specifically for the women, I do believe that sometimes we are incorrectly stereotyped as well. And that's a fun angle to really consider and talk about too. This year actually marks the 75th anniversary of the Women's Armed Services Integration Act. So away went the WAC, and now we were just fully integrated into the military branches. And so as we're celebrating 75 years of integration, it's unique to look back at all of the things that we have accomplished, you know. And I think that we get stuck, Dale, when we talk about what military women experience. I think we get stuck in so much of the negative, and we get stuck in the discussions of the work that we still have to do, when really just to take a little bit of a pause and celebrate some amazing things is a really good outlook to have on it too. So that's what we try to focus on.
I think so. And I wanted to make sure that we get you to talk about your upcoming event in April of this year.
Yes, this is a huge success for us. So Women Veterans Strong is all about peer support. We have three things we focus on. The first is getting rid of that stigma that's attached to mental wellness and seeking help for issues there. The third is testimonials, being able to tell our stories. And the second is self-advocacy. And we want to advocate not only for ourselves, we want to be able to tell our stories, but we also want to advocate for other military women, the women on our left and our right. And so it starts with peer support of figuring out, well, what is the story of the military woman on my left and my right? And then how can I serve her? How does she need my support in life? And so it really was through that vision that we became involved with an organization out in California. And the event there is called Women Veterans Engage. And so just this past September, we hosted our first Women's Veteran Engage Detroit event, where we brought together 86 women, military women from the state of Michigan and really all over, because we had some remote attendees, And we watched some national broadcast speakers. We took the pedal cars out downtown in Detroit. Oh man, Detroit was taken by storm by military women that day. That was so much fun. And it was a chance for us to gather and to engage in some professional development with each other as peers. So we just did that in September. And then we are redoing it again in April. National went ahead and said that their 2023 dates are April 28 and 29. So that's what we have coming up in April. It's Women Veterans Engage Detroit. And we decided, much like you, Dale, that we can't just meet the standard. We have to exceed the standard. So we actually blew up that event to a full two-day leadership conference. So it is no longer just a peer type event for military women. It's a two-day leadership conference. We're calling it the Others Over Self 23 Leadership Conference and Women Veterans Engage Detroit. And it is hosted this year. It's being presented by General Motors. So we've really been lifted up by the community at large in the state of Michigan. And it's so cool because we have the opportunity as military women to take the stage on the leadership standpoint. And we're being given the microphone and the opportunity to present some incredible professional development modules that can only be told through our unique perspective. And so my presenters are male and female, and we also are leaning heavily into the support of military women during that weekend. So we are inviting everyone, if you consider yourself a business professional or somebody that really loves to just engage in professional development, to come out to our conference. And we have been so blessed by our sponsors that we are offering complimentary tickets for military women. So they don't even have to pay. That's how much we just want to love on them and bring them together and give them an opportunity to shine with each other.
And where would they go to get those tickets?
That's a good question. I know I emailed you the link. Just kidding. It's tinyurl.com/WVE-Detroit. tinyurl.com/WVE-Detroit.
Okay. Is there a phone number that they could call if they're not that computer literate?
Like they me? Always can. Yes, we have our Women Veteran Strong program has a hotline, and that number is 248-519-2325, 248-519-2325.
Okay, and that website is womenveteranstrong.org.
Yes, and you'll find contact information for everything on there, womenveteranstrong.org.
I think that's great. I think this is terrific. I'm really excited about not only what you are doing, but where you are, expanding out and offering all of these services, you know, not just to women veterans, but to veterans in general, which is, you know, so important. I think this generation, as we were talking earlier, now here we are on the day, 20 years ago is when the invasion of Iraq occurred. And, these men and women are finally able to, transition out if they want to. And, we've got to be able to help them continue with their careers, continue with their lives, and let them live out their dreams like people did for us.
And I think Dale, that's you make such a good point. I feel like sometimes there's a huge brick wall that we put up between the military and civilian worlds, and that is not the case. I know that I have found in the state of Michigan open arms being welcoming me in from a corporate sector standpoint. So when I think about our veteran support network, I don't necessarily look to your traditional nonprofit VSOs, if you will. I'm more reaching out to companies like General Motors. And what's so cool about our April event is that we're hosting it at the Michigan Regional Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. So this is the Michigan Union for Carpentry and Millwrights at their skilled training center in Detroit. And so they actually have as one of their auxiliaries, the Sisters in the Brotherhood. So these are all of the women carpenters and millwrights that have their own gathering. And so how cool is it to see that civilian entity and the military entities coming together, lifting each other up? Like I said, they're just, for some reason, I think in our minds, there's a huge wall between military and civilian. And it's so easy to just say, well, we are different and they don't get me. And nobody understands what I've been through. But the truth of the matter is if we open our hearts and if we allow a little bit of transparency into our lives and into our experiences, you'll find that there's a lot of people that have been through what we have been through. It might not look exactly the same, That's the beauty of being an individual. But a lot of people in our world have shared experiences. And the more that we can connect with each other, the better off we are long term.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you very much. Shelley Rood with her organization, Women's Veterans Strong. For more information, you can go to the website that she gave out, or you can go to our website, veteransradio.net, and there's a link there that will take her to her stuff and everything that's coming up. And I look forward to hearing more about the event that's going to be happening at the end of April. And thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio. You're more than welcome to stay if you'd like to for the remainder, because it seems like you guys, women, excuse me, I have to remember this stuff. I'm old, what can I say? To talk more about women in the military, kind of the history of it and so forth.
Oh, I'm staying on. I'm not going to miss this discussion. Christine Cook is coming up, and she's a powerhouse.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. As she just said, we're going to be transitioning right into our next guest today, who is Colonel Christine Cook, United States Army retired, also PhD, and now she's a doctor, which is kind of cool. And I think I might have mentioned earlier on that Christine was on our program first back in 2006 when we were mere children. And we were talking about her experiences in Kuwait, and her book was entitled Living on Tatooine, which is kind of a cool title, I thought, better, aka Kuwait. So I got to meet Christine. I got to meet her whole family, which was kind of great, too, because I had her husband on, Ken, to talk about being the parent left at home with two children. So right now, Christine is an assistant professor at the United States Army War College. Woohoo. And she's continuing right on. So, Christine, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So today what we're going to be talking about, I should have had, one of my other women members of our board on as the host, talking about the history of women in the military. And when I was thinking about this or researching it, I'm going, oh, I got to find a Medal of Honor recipient. There's got to be a woman out there somewhere, and there's only one. And just briefly, I'm not going to do the whole thing with the music and everything else, but it's Dr. Mary Walker. And Dr. Mary Walker is the only female Medal of Honor recipient. And it started out during the Civil War. She had went to medical school, graduated from Syracuse, which was kind of interesting, went into private practice, but then the Civil War broke out in 1861. She wanted to join the Army as a surgeon, but wasn't allowed, surprise, because she was a woman. But because of her credentials, she didn't want to be a nurse either, so she chose to volunteer for the Union Army. Mm-hmm. So she worked for free at a temporary hospital set up at the U.S. Patent Office in Washington, D.C. I have been in that building. It's really beautiful. She also organized a women's relief organization to help the families of the wounded who came to visit at local hospitals. She moved to Virginia in 1862, this time to treat the wounded at field hospitals. In 1863, her medical credentials were finally accepted, so she moved to Tennessee, where she was appointed as a War Department surgeon. Her position was paid, and it was the equivalent of like a lieutenant. Said she was captured in 1864 by the South. Who knew? And held as a prisoner of war for about 4 months. She and other Union doctors were eventually exchanged in a prisoner of war exchange for Confederate medical officers. And according to the National Library of Medicine sources, Walker had been captured intentionally so she could spy for the North, but there's no evidence of that. Not long after being released by the Confederates, she returned to being a medical director at a hospital for women prisoners in Kentucky. She was also an outspoken advocate for women's rights. Surprise. The war raged on. Feminists also struggled to further their cause, which included being able to wear clothing that allowed them to move around better. She chose to wear what is known as a bloomer costume. I thought that was interesting. It's a modified uniform throughout the war. It's a dress and trouser combination. She eventually switched to wearing men's clothes and was even arrested for impersonating a man. This is crazy. In her defense, she argued that she was given special permission by the government to dress that way. In November of 1865, having left government service for good, she was awarded the Medal of Honor by President Andrew Johnson, even though she was a civilian who had never been commissioned as a military office. That civilian status was why her medal was rescinded in 1917, 2 years before she died. She refused to return the medal, though.
Well, and I think they gave it back to her just recently.
Yeah, they did. Spoiling my story here.
Sorry.
60 years after that, President Jimmy Carter restored the honor in her name. And so we want to thank Dr. Mary Walker for representing all women in this long line of Honorable Medal of Honor recipients. I think that's a great story. And I can't imagine, that kind of gives me my segue into talking with Christine Cook here, who is an expert on women in the military, as her dissertation pointed out to us. So, Christine, tell us about, I guess we can go back to World War II, mm-hmm. Actually when they first allowed women to even get near the military.
Well, that's not exactly true because, of course, you know, in Civil War and even in the Revolutionary War, we always had women who were actually helping on the sidelines. They were often in the nurses' positions. And as we can see, Dr. Mary Walker was also basically in the military, even if she didn't have rank. We also had some people who dressed up as men. And when they died was when people sometimes found out that, ooh, that was a woman. Not a man. So, I mean, that happened throughout. The women did try to become part of the military in the World War I time frame. And in fact, they had yeomanettes and marinettes who were part of the military, but not getting paid as a military person. And of course, we had nurses and we had doctors in World War I. So the Army Nurses Corps can actually date themselves back to World War I. But when we're talking about women in as a, you know, having rank and getting equal pay, that happened during World War II. So first, they started out as auxiliary corps. So the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps, or the WAAC, W-A-A-C, started in 1942. There were other sister services that had that. The Marines had a group that were auxiliary, and the WAVES, which I can never remember what WAVES stands for, but part of it is volunteering for emergency service. So those were women who were part of the auxiliary. In 1943, they decided that it was more important for women to be able to actually do a military job. And so they switched it so that it was an actual Army position, Navy position, Marine position, or SPARS, the Coast Guard, through the end of the war. That was the plan. So in 1945, when the war ended, the idea was, the military women are going to go away. They're going to go home. They're going to get married. They're going to have 2.5 children because that's what women should do, because they were trying to kind of reestablish something that had never actually been legitimately the tradition, but the idea that women would stay at home and men would work. So that was kind of this civilian idea, right? But the Cold War was starting. And so people in the military realized fairly quickly on that they really wanted to keep women in the military. And that's, as Shelley mentioned, when the Women's Armed Services Integration Act came into effect. They started building it in 1946. It got passed by the Senate in 1947 and then got bogged down in the House of Representatives for a little while. But it eventually became a law in 1948. Now, the concept of it being integration, I would use air quotes around, because by and large, while women were now a permanent part of the structure, they were not integrated into the military. They tended to work in parallel or separate. They had training that was separate. They had facilities that were separate. After 1959, they weren't allowed to be on the rifle team, as an example. And so the idea of integration was a long time in coming.
I'll bet. It sounds like it. That's for sure. I have to pull up this chat that we got that said, whoops, just got myself cut off.
Oh, there we go. Yep. Accepted for voluntary emergency service.
Yep. There we go. Yep. So my question to you is that with the integration of everybody into their service under Truman, I guess, is where this all occurred, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you were mentioning that that after the war that the women were supposed to go home and, you know, be the traditional moms, mothers, and so forth that many of us grew up with in the '50s and so forth. But you also said that there were certain restrictions for the women that were in the military. Could you go into that a little bit? We're talking with sure. Christine Cook, who is our expert on women in the military.
Right. So first of all, they were not allowed to be more than 2% of the total strength of the military at any given time. So if we had 100,000 people in the military, that means, I'm not very good at math, but let's say 2,000 would be allowed to be in the military. Right. And so that was the cap for Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines. In addition, they also had a rank cap for up until 1967, where women were only allowed up to the rank of lieutenant colonel, and only one at a time in each branch of service was allowed to be a colonel, and that would be the director of the Women's Air Force, the Navy, or the WAC. And they thought for a while about the idea of basically just giving a discharge upon marriage, if women decided to get married. But then they decided, no, we'll lose too many people that way. So what we'll do is we'll voluntarily allow them to discharge if they wish to be discharged. That being said, up until 1974 or 75, you basically could not have a child. So the minute you got pregnant, you would be summarily discharged, an honorable discharge, but it was still a discharge. You were not allowed to be a mother. You were not allowed to have dependents. And so even though the idea was that it was equal pay for equal rank, that was true to a point, but they were not allowed in any combat positions. Therefore, there was no combat pay. There was no hazardous duty pay. Women did not get it. Plus, they didn't have housing ability because they weren't allowed to have dependents. Therefore, they should be able to live in, you know, the enlisted quarters or in an officer's quarters. And so if they married a man who was in the military, then they could live in the house of his rank, not her rank. So even though she might have been a lieutenant colonel and he was a sergeant, they would be in sergeant's quarters because she didn't count. And she could not claim dependence except in one instance. And that is if she could prove that the person she had married could not have a job, then she could claim him as a dependent. And I think that the idea was if a woman decided to marry somebody who was a, disabled veteran, that she could then claim that person as a dependent. I think that was the real point. Okay. But they didn't want that to happen. So by and large, it was basically, you are not allowed to have a dependent. So those were just a couple of the things that they wrote right into the Women's Armed Services Integration Act. And it remained statute until 1978.
Wow. I was just thinking when you're saying about the, I never even contemplated this because I never lived on a military base. I mean, other than when I was in flight school and, you know, going through basic training and a lot of other stuff. But once I got married, we got to move off and they never invited us to live on Fort Rucker. But so the housing is based on rank as well. So assuming what like a sergeant starts off in a 2-bedroom cement brick house and then you kind of move up.
Yeah.
If he's
or an apartment. Yep.
Okay. I did not know that. Yeah. See, listen to Veterans Radio, learn all these different great facts and so forth as we go along. Right. So you mentioned that, you know, many of these things started training. I know that women were not allowed in flight schools. And as you've said, they were not allowed in combat at all. Mm-hmm. And when did that start to change?
Okay, well, believe it or not, Vietnam did change a couple of things. So one of the things that ended up happening is eventually women were allowed to volunteer to go to Vietnam. They didn't get hazardous duty pay because the idea was they were not going to be in a hazardous duty position. They were going to be in Saigon. They were going to be in, you know, fill in the blank. They eventually got to 100% strength in January of 1968. Now, if anything, and anybody knows anything about Vietnam, they might realize they got at full strength right around Tet. So guess what got attacked when they were on the ground? Their base. Yes. Because it was a huge logistics base. And so lots of mortars went into the area where they were, but they weren't getting hazardous duty pay, even though they were jumping behind bunkers. And of course, remember, they weren't allowed to use weapons either. So there they are in Vietnam, weaponless, trying
not getting paid. And not getting that whopping $65 a month.
Exactly.
Hazardous duty pay.
And so one of the things also was that President Johnson actually had an assistant who was a reservist, she was like one of his executive assistants, right? He wanted her to be a colonel, a full colonel. And they said, nope, there are no such things except for the director of the branch. And he said, baloney.
Thank you.
We should have more than that. So in 1967, they decided, number one, that there would be no rank limit. And number two, that there would be more than just one colonel. And so the director actually became a brigadier general at that point in time. And then in the early 1970s, as they were trying to get rid of the selective service, they switched to the all-volunteer force. They figured that all of the men would sit there and say, not interested in joining the military. Thank you very much. I'm off. Not going to volunteer in any way, shape, or form. So they figured, well, it seems like women are interested in this. So let's improve recruitment to try to get more women in. And when they did that, then they also realized that they also had to change certain things. Like there's probably shouldn't be a voluntary discharge for women who get married, as an example. If they get pregnant, they should not be thrown out. They should be allowed to have more than one dependent. All of the rules should be the same for men and women when it came to dependency. Now, granted, it's a little hard to prove when you have a father, right? But, you know, all of these dependency rules should be the same. So now we've got a situation where they're allowed to, what they decided was women should be allowed to have as many kids as they want, but you're only allowed to claim three dependents, one spouse, two kids. That was all that you were allowed to do. You could have eight, sure, go for it, but you're only paid for three. Right. And that's for both men and women. So that's one of the reasons why, you know, if you're in the military and you want to claim dependence, maximum three. And they also, by doing that, made it that if you're a colonel in the military, like me, when I went on duty at the war college while I was still in the military, I got colonel's quarters. I did not get, you know, I was able to live on post because I was a woman claiming three dependents. So, and let's see. So the other thing is that they decided as this was happening and more training was coeducational, they started getting rid of the training for the WACs. And that was basically by the mid-1970s, the only thing that the WAC was for training. And so they decided that with one thing and another, they would get rid of the statute for the Women's Armed Services Integration Act, fully integrate into the military. And that happened about 1978.
Oh, this is really interesting. We are talking here with retired Colonel Christine Cook, also now a doctor, also in women's women in the military, extraordinaire expert of ours. And I guess my question was, when in the mid-70s, I guess it was, I remember was seeing a TV program where, who was that? Patty Duke. Patty Duke evidently ended up going through flight school. And that was the first time I had seen it. And I have to say, my group of, you know, of people were going, what? You can't do that. And so forth. And I'm sure that it had to be really difficult to get the, you know, get women into some of these quote combat situations. But I guess they figured that if she's in the air, she's not in, you know, on the ground and so forth.
There's actually the flying is an interesting point, because first of all, one of the things that happened in the 1970s as they got rid of the WAC, is that they realized that they had to officially put together a policy for the combat exclusion policy. So it was around 1977, 1978 that they came up with this idea that women could not be on the front line. And so basically that precluded them from being in the infantry, the armor, field artillery, engineers, I always forget one. But anyway, one of them was combat flying. They were not allowed to combat fly. They were, however, allowed to do flights that were logistics and also some medical, depending. So the women who were learning how to fly were basically learning how to fly the logistics or the medical flights. And it was not until the 1990s that they decided that, I think because of perhaps because of Desert Storm, that they realized there's no such thing as keeping people who are flying away from possible combat. And so that's when they decided that combat flight was also possible. And that's the first one that basically became a combat duty that women could actually do.
You know, I was just thinking, when you're talking about logistics, that means taking supplies out into the field and dropping them off. And that was sometimes the most dangerous thing that
exactly,
we ever did.
Exactly. So it was kind of artificial.
Okay.
And with Operation Iraqi Freedom, everybody realized that, you know, the biggest threat is anybody who's on the roads. That meant anyone. Right, because of the IEDs and things like that. So the idea of combat was really blurring, and plenty of women were in combat positions, even though they weren't combat positions on paper. And that's when things really had to change. They realized that they had to change. So 2015 was when they finally decided they were going to open it up to any woman who was physically able to do those particular positions.
And I think that's the important words that you just used there, was that they're physically able to do the work. It's like, you know, that there are women firefighters and there are women, you know, police officers and stuff. As long as they can do the job physically, that makes sense.
Well, and let's be clear, there are plenty of men who can't quite do infantry work either.
Yes, I know a few of those.
The other truth is that for every one position that is a combat position, there are 9 people supporting them. And so, you know, the truth is that 90% of the population of the military could be, you know, not in a combat position and still helping to support the military in some way or another.
So what's the case today? What's going on today? Everybody's allowed to do whatever they want?
You know, yes and no, right?
Okay.
One of the things that happened in 2015 was that they also attempted to introduce a new PT test, physical training test. And the idea behind the physical training test was that you would get a certain percentage. And if you were in, you know, let's say, my field, which was personnel, you don't have to be, you know, as physically qualified. So you get to, you know, score 70% on this test, right? and on up to, if you're infantry, you better be getting a 100% on this test, right? The truth is, a lot of men have trouble passing this particular test, but there is one event in particular that most women cannot do. And it is a weird hold like this. And then you do.
She's got, we're on a radio, so she's got her hands up in the air.
You're holding, you're like on a pull-up bar, right? You're holding like this, and you have to lift your legs up to your chest. All right. Women have significant difficulties holding this position for that long. A lot of men do too, actually. But because of that, a lot of women are failing the test, and they're probably going to have to go back to square one on that test. But either way, they have situations where it's like, you know, if you are qualifying for Ranger school, then you can go to Ranger school. And we have actually for the first time, as of about a year ago, right, 2021, her promotion was held up because of the president before, I think. But either way, we have a 4-star general in the Army, and she is a combatant commander for Southcom. So that is the first woman who has been in one of those positions ever. So, you know, the world can be the oyster, but, you know, there are still issues. And there was a big backlash in 2016, 2017. And I think you can still sometimes see it, especially in the Marine Corps, where the Marine Corps basically said, not interested in having women in combat positions. And, you know, we've been forcing them, but they're making it very unpleasant for the women who even try. Right. So when you look at our percentage in the military at this point, the highest percentage has always been the Air Force. They're at roughly 19%, hovering almost close to 20, followed by the Army, which is at about 18%. I believe that the Navy is around 17%, and the Marines are at 9%.
That makes sense, I guess.
Good old
I would suppose. I said over your time in the Army, Christine, we're talking, as I said, you were talking with Christine Cook, a retired colonel. How did the change for you? Because you went through ROTC, didn't you?
I did go through ROTC. And in fact, ROTC started, that was the first thing that basically chipped away at the WAC, because they started allowing women into the ROTC starting in 1972. And so I got a full-blown scholarship in 1982 for 4 years at a pretty good university, basically commissioned. But at the time, I was not allowed to be in a combat position. Not that I really wanted one, actually, you know, wanted to go military intelligence, but it was like 6 months to get the top secret clearance. And I was National Guard 3 hours away from where I lived. What with one thing and another, I finally decided I needed to find something closer to home. And that happened to be a personnel position. So I ended up being personnel for the majority of my career. The PT test was one of those things where it started out being honestly a little too easy for women. And as Title IX went into effect and more women got equal pay for their, you know, college and high school sports, women were getting better at the PT tests. And so over my entire time frame, the PT test standards got higher and higher and higher, so that, you know, they changed it with age. But by the time I retired, I was still doing the same PT test I had to do as an 18-year-old. So it was, you know, there was improvements over time with that, that women were becoming more and more, were getting stronger and stronger and less likely to be the weaker sex, so to speak. Of course, I did deploy. I was in the, you know, an area that was not expected to see combat. But then again, I did fly in at least a couple of times to places that were technically under combat conditions while I was there. And there was nothing that was stopping me. you know, and that was, as I said, about the time when people started realizing there is no such thing as a front line and we're not going to be protecting women. So by the time I was finished in 2016, you know, 2015 was when they announced that there would be no more combat exclusion policy, right about the time when I was leaving. So.
And how many women are in the general rank nowadays? Because I know that's one of the reasons why you left. Because this is
I left because I hit my mandatory retirement.
Oh, well, you hit that 30-year thing.
Yeah, I was in for 30 years, and they were telling me I had to leave. So I don't actually have the exact number. But it was always kind of lagging when I was there that, you know, when you say that there's, you know, when I was in, it was about 15% of the women in the military, but about 3% in the general officer corps, 3% in the colonel corps, you know. And so I was one of 3% as a colonel and, you know, even less people. And you've got a situation where there's approximately 300 active duty generals and maybe 10 or 15 of them are women.
Yeah. Makes sense. I want to bring Shelley back into the conversation because she's been listening attentively as we've been giving a history of women. Cause you were in intelligence.
I was, I don't know what that says about me, but I was.
But you were able to get into that MOS, correct?
Yes. Yep. Yeah. And I was a distinguished military graduate from Western Michigan. So I was able to choose my branch. And I grew up in the 90s looking at like April O'Neil and Dana Scully on television. Those are pop culture references of women who are in journalism and the intelligence world. And so I genuinely, like, I thought I was going to grow up and be a secret spy or an FBI agent. So when I was given the opportunity and they said, what branch do you want to choose? I was intel all the way. I mean, I was so thankful for the opportunity to be behind the scenes, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And so where did you receive that training?
The United States Army Intelligence School is mostly based out of Fort Huachuca, Arizona.
Okay. Did you ever get the, I mean, obviously you use it, but you can't tell us, otherwise you have to kill us. Okay.
Well, that's true.
We don't want that.
Well, and ironically, by the time I got to be a colonel, I was actually put into an intel slot. But I couldn't train there because they only train up through major. So I was doing it kind of on the job training.
Well, my question is to the effect of, you know, how you felt about your experiences in the military themselves and where you think it's going. And Shelley, I'm going to ask you too. We're back talking with Shelley Rood here, who's was a captain in the Army when she got out. So what do you think, where do you think it's going?
That is a good question. You know, I can celebrate from the perspective where I saw a lot of integration. And even though I was often the only female in the room as a military woman, I mean, all of my analysts over the years were males. I think I only ever had two females that I ever was in charge of or, you know, had to kind of handle in any way. They've always been males. And even from a command standpoint, I was under one-star general that was a female, and I did have one colonel who was a female. But other than that, it was males across the board. But I can honestly say that even though I was the only female in the room, a lot of the times I never felt like I was alone because I knew that there were women in those positions, you know, and that's a lot thanks to the leadership from Christine and a lot of women that were 5, 10, 15 years ahead of me. So they did that hard work and climbed those ranks and got into those positions. And so I had the beautiful opportunity to just see that as, well, yeah, that's how it is. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't experience a lot of that stereotyping, whereas I know a lot of military women have. And that's why I enjoy hearing their stories, because for me, it was not a major part of my military career.
Well, that's, I mean, it's it's good to know that they're evolving, mm-hmm. you know, and kind of, you know, catching up or with the rest of the of our civilization or our country as far as, you know, the equality wars are going. Because when you think about what was, you know, what happened when Truman, you know, integrated the military, that caused a big turmoil, mm-hmm. you know, and, but it
happened 6 weeks after the Women's Armed Services Integration Act.
Yeah. But I mean, it set the tone. I mean, it really did. It set the tone for the 50s and 60s from a historical perspective. Mm-hmm. Hey, finally. Okay.
And that's not to say that there's not issues that we face. There are issues that we face. You know, you still separate males and females when we go out to the field. I mean, I'm Army. You don't set your tent up right next to the males. And so I was just talking with a retired colonel friend, and she was the fighter pilot, and she's the only female. And so they would go off for training, and the males would be in one area, and she would be clear on like a hotel off the base because that was the only lodging for a female that they could have. So you want to talk about, like, it sounds great to have everybody integrated, and yet we do have life experience that shows us, well, how am I supposed to be growing my team when I'm on the other side of the base? Whereas they're all getting together, you know, for those 2 a.m. runs down to the kitchen or whatever. She's never had the opportunity to be a part of that camaraderie. Yeah. So, you know, there's challenges that we're always going to face when you talk about the integration of the genders. But I just am an advocate for where things are going, because I do see a lot of hope, a lot of promise. And at the same time, I think that we need to not forget that the genders are different. As Christine pointed out, we are physically different, and our brains are even wired a little bit different as well. And so there are things that we are going to excel at more. And there are also things that the men will accelerate more. And that doesn't mean that one is better than the other. It means, as my husband and I always say, equal but different.
Equal but different. Yeah. Well, and actually, you know, talking about living on Tatooine, Dale might remember that I ended up talking about the fact that, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. And we had a situation where I was the only officer, and there were a total of 3 women in my unit. And we actually had a situation where I originally set up my point so that, you know, I was in one hooch, and in the same tent down the hall was my 2 officers who were male. And I really liked that because I felt a lot more, honestly, safer knowing that I had 2 guys who weren't going to do anything dumb with me because I outranked them. Right. And so then, you know, a new guy came on that was running that base. He said, we can't have males and females in the same tent together. He pulled my 2 guys. And after 2 days of watching, you know, 6,000 men who I didn't know coming on and going into Iraq, I walked in and I said, you're going to give me my 2 majors back because I do not feel comfortable being alone on this base. And luckily, I also outranked him, so I was able to get my way.
And praise the Lord for that, because there's so many women who find themselves falling under that military or government regulation where we don't have the rank. Mm-hmm. And that's where you're right. The stupid decisions, right? Or the wrong decisions are being made sometimes without an understanding of our perspective. And that's why you have to listen to the perspective of the people involved.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Okay, well, we've got about 3 minutes to go, so I'm going to ask for a final statement of women in the military from Christine. What have you got? Where do you see this going?
I think that, you know, as Shelley was saying, one of the things that we are seeing is more and more the things that are in the non-combat areas, the places where women have been for 75 years, men and women are working side by side together, and they really almost don't even blink. It does not matter. And they are very comfortable with each other, and they form a siblings in arms, you know, rather than a brothers in arms, right? There are still some issues with trying to go into the combat arms there are plenty of men who do not want women to be there. And so it's probably going to take almost another 20 or 30 years before people start feeling comfortable about that too.
Okay. Shelley, I'll give you the last word. I got about a minute left.
Well, if you're a woman and you're going to serve in the military, it's going to be hard. And if you can accept that and know that every footstep forward, you're going to face challenges, both seen and unforeseen, then you're going to be just fine. But if you think you're going to walk in to the military and things are going to be handed to you on a silver platter, you are absolutely wrong. So if you're willing to step up, if you're willing to do the hard work, then welcome. And we would love to have you, and your nation needs you.
And one last time, could you remind our audience of your conference coming up in April?
April 28 and 29. And we are at the, you can go to tinyurl.com/WVE-Detroit. This is a 2-day leadership conference and Women Veterans Engage event.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you both. Thank you, Shelley Rood.
Thank
Christine
you.
Cook, I greatly appreciate you being on Veterans Radio today. We'll be back next week with our benefits program. So if you have any questions about that, we're going to be talking especially about women veterans and how they're getting along with the VA system that's out there, because we know it's another issue that, you know, going on. And we thank you all for tuning in and listening to Veterans Radio. This program will be up on our website later on this evening. I want to thank everybody. I thank our guests, thank our sponsors. And until next week, this is Dale Thronberry for Veterans Radio, and you are dismissed. Thank you.